evening I wanted to say some words on the theme of compassion. And part of the motivation for doing that this evening was I spent some time talking with a woman today who was taking care of her elderly, sick mother. She's moved out to California so she can... The mother was moved out here so the daughter could take care of her. And she's having a hard time finding a nursing home that'll take her mother because her mother is so difficult. And right now the mother's in a psychiatric hospital. And just listening to the story of suffering, it was quite painful, and you know, it didn't seem like there was any particular solutions. Our society doesn't not set up so well to take care of the elderly often, and even with all the money that they had available for them, they just couldn't find a nursing home that was willing to take on someone who was so demanding and so much need. And so I was listening to this woman's distress, her suffering, her sadness, her grief, her anger, and it didn't seem to me that certainly I could do anything for her, and I wondered if she could do anything for her, for the situation itself, for her mother. And it just seemed a situation where certainly compassion was evoked, but compassion that has seemingly had no easy solution. Just sit there with the suffering of it all. So that's been on my mind today, and there's been a series of things like that lately for me, where you're sitting in the middle of great suffering, and seemingly with an ideal world, there'd be a solution. You'd fix it somehow, but not necessarily seeing or knowing how you could fix something which shouldn't be, but there it is anyway. So suffering, we sit in suffering. Suffering gives birth to compassion. And as an introduction to this topic, I wanted to mention when I was new to Buddhism in the 70s, and I had a conversation once with a Zen teacher who explained to me, was talking to me about the teaching, Buddhist teaching of no self and self and all that. And he said that there were two approaches to the spiritual life. One was to realize that there is no self, to realize that to empty yourself of yourself entirely. And the other path is to realize that the self is huge. The self encompasses everything. So on one hand was to collapse the self until it totally disappears, and the other was to expand the self until it includes everything. And he claimed that both were very valid paths, and both paths led to exactly the same place. If you as an individual disappear, then you're left with no boundaries to the cosmos around you. And if you become the cosmos, then there's again no boundaries between you and the cosmos, or something like that. And then I went to IMS in the 1980s, and there was a saying that was posted on the walls there someplace, think above the bowling alley maybe. Not every retreat center has a bowling alley. But we do it well, American Vipassana circles. So we have a bowling alley. Not that I ever saw anyone use it. Except for walking meditation, they'd get up on top of it and walk back and forth on the alley. And this saying said, this quote said something like, wisdom teaches me that I'm nothing, and love teaches me that I'm everything. So it's a little bit similar to what the Zen teacher was telling me. Wisdom teaches me that I'm nothing, and love teaches me that I'm everything. And then the quote goes on somewhere, maybe some of you know it, about, and in between the two, my life flows, between those two. And why I wanted to refer to this in talking about compassion is that perhaps we have a strong tendency to want to focus on one solution, one answer, one teaching, one understanding, which, you know, if we get that one understanding, then everything else is taken care of. Like, we have this the fallacy of a single answer. But rather than thinking that there's one answer to spiritual quests, maybe there's several equally compatible or complementary answers. And so, on one hand, we can both see that wisdom teaches me that I'm nothing. On the other hand, that love teaches me that I'm everything. That both need to be understood, or both together make up the spiritual life, not one or the other. Even though some people might focus more on wisdom and less on love, and some people more on love and less on wisdom. Now, how does this relate to this compassion? We'll see. So this is a little bit of going to be a little bit of a Zen talk, in the sense that I'm going to try to convey to you something I've learned about compassion from my Zen practice, and hopefully it's something which is useful for other people, some sense, some understanding of compassion, the nature of it. And that is, start off by telling you a Zen koan, a Zen story. There were these two monks speaking, and one monk said, what is it like for Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of great compassion, to have so many hands? And in Mahayana Buddhist mythology or iconography, the Bodhisattva of great compassion is sometimes depicted with 10,000, sometimes 84,000 hands and arms that radiate out all around. You've probably seen paintings or statues of such things. And in each hand, there's often an eye, and then in each hand is holding some implement, usually. And many kinds of implements, many kinds of tools and stuff. And what's known by everyone is that, at least in East Asia, is that this Bodhisattva of great compassion has all these eyes on their hands and all these hands and all these tools to be infinitely helpful to the beings of the world, to address the issue of suffering, that people suffer. And Avalokiteshvara is going to meet that suffering in some useful way. And so the monk asks, you know, what is it like for Avalokiteshvara to have so many hands? And the second monk responds, it's like in the middle of the night, half asleep, reaching up behind my head to adjust the pillow. So, the first monk is asking about, you know, what is it like to be engaged compassionately with the suffering of the world? And he gets some pillow answer. But I think it's a very profound answer, and that's why I wanted to talk about it. My sense of the example of the adjusting the pillow in the middle of the night is that we do that when we feel a little bit uncomfortable, things a little bit off a little bit, maybe our neck is a little bit tight or scrunched or I don't know what. And so the hands go up back and kind of pushes the pillow a little bit and makes it a little higher, a little lower, you know, just something to make it more comfortable for the head. But there's no self-reflective thoughts about doing that. A person's not thinking, I'm going to do this so that other people can think of me as the world's greatest pillow adjuster. Or, you know, it's almost as if it's kind of an automatic or response to this little bit of discomfort. And without thinking about it, without being concerned about anything, somehow, in a natural way, the hand goes up there and adjusts the pillow. And this describes how Avalokiteshvara responds to the suffering of the world. That Avalokiteshvara, in the same way, responds as naturally to the suffering of the world as you would adjust a pillow in the middle of the night. So to maybe kind of extend this analogy a little bit into wider life, at home, my wife and I and our 2.5-year-old son, we all sleep together. We took the frame off our futon, so the futon's on the floor, and he has a futon next to our futon. So we have these two futons kind of next to each other. And so we all kind of sleep happily, more or less, there together. And so sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night, or I'll go to sleep in the evening after he's asleep, or I wake up in the morning and he's still asleep. And I notice that the blankets are not over him, that he's kicked the blankets off. And in my better moments, I will just very naturally, without any thought about myself and my needs, my sleep, we'll just kind of reach over there and put a blanket over him. I'm not concerned about getting praised. I'm not concerned about rousing myself even more up from my sleep if it's the middle of the night. It just seems this is what has to happen. It's almost as if he's an extension of myself, and as in the same way that I would adjust a pillow for myself at night, I do this for my son. And maybe many parents have some, in their better moments, maybe have that kind of experience. It's certainly easy to have the other kind of experience where, in the sense where you see someone else out there who has some need, and then you treat them as an object, and we treat ourselves as an object, and then it becomes, I'm doing it for that person. And I'm the one who's doing it for that person. Which, in normal language, we talk that way all the time. But in that experience of adjusting the blankets on my son, it isn't like he's out there and I'm here. I'm not living with him as the object of my attention. And he's out there, I'm going to respond to his need. And I'm the responder to the need. That kind of self-conscious concern, self-reflective concern, where there's an object and me the subject of the experience, is absent. Now, if you ask me, I mean, it isn't like I'm stupid, you know. I mean, if you ask me, you know, is he over there and you there, and are you the one doing it? Of course, I'll say yes. But in the moment of doing it, I'm not thinking that way. I'm just very, very kind of spontaneously reaching out because it needs to be done, without any real thought that that's different than me or the same as me even. It's just what needs to be done. Now, compassion is considered to be one of the great ideals of Buddhism, and responding to the world compassionately is considered to be very, you know, a very beautiful and noble thing to do. And some people feel oppressed by this ideal. Or some people will feel inspired by it and then try to live by it and try to go off into the world and be compassionate. And then there's compassion fatigue. They get exhausted. They get tired. They get overwhelmed. They get frightened. And I think that when we live in the world of objects, there's a need out there that I am the one who's going to address, then it's a setup for compassion fatigue. It's a setup for all kinds of problems. What I learned from doing Zen practice, when I first started doing meditation practice, is that there's a way of meeting the suffering of the world where the suffering of the world isn't out there in someone else. Now, in normal language, of course it is. If you asked me, where is the suffering? You know, I'd say, well, it's that person over there. However, this is why I started off by saying you need to be able to hold two different understandings at the same time. It isn't only one way. But if you can step out of our normal subject and object way of thinking about things, even though it's quite an innocent thing to do, there's a whole other way of experiencing life where we don't see anything as the object of our awareness, the object of our knowing. There is certainly knowing of it. It isn't like you then become blind to the world. We know it. We know the people around us. We know the situation. We know the suffering. But we don't think of it as an object out there. We just think this is what's happening here. This is what's happening in the same way that my son has a need for the blanket to be pulled over him. I do it without thinking that he's out there and I'm here. I'm not doing it with any reference to myself as a doer. I'm not doing it with any reference to my son as being the person who has a need. If I do it with a notion that I'm the doer, in and of itself, that's an innocent idea to have, because after all, I am the doer putting the blanket over him. But if I have the notion I'm the doer, that's a magnet for all kinds of other ideas. And the other ideas often are ideas in Buddhism are called conceit. Of we make ourselves into something. I'm the one who's doing it. I need to become something. I'm not good enough. I'm the great bodhisattva of compassion. I hope everybody notices how great I am. Or, you know, there's all kinds of ideas of self that get mixed in with that once we start forming a subject-object relationship to this world. So what's possible is to experience the suffering of the world, or to experience the world entirely as it is, without objectifying the world, without seeing the world outside as an object that I'm going to be engaged in. Now, some people hear that and they say, well, that means you can become a passive amoeba, a lump on the floor, a couch potato. But it doesn't work that way. The experience of not taking things out there as being the object, I think, lends itself to us responding to the world more freely. When I don't take my son as the object in his need, I just kind of pull the cover over him. That's like my better moments. I've had lots of moments where I woke up in the middle of the night and said, oh my sleep, how am I going to manage tomorrow without getting enough sleep? Now he needs me, he's crying or whatever, and you know, this, you know, or maybe my wife will get up and walk him to sleep now, or, you know, or get into this whole argument in my head about whose turn it is, or you know, my need, I have to take care of myself, or maybe, you know, maybe I will go take care of him now, but I hope my wife notices what a great husband and father I am. So, you know, those are the other moments, right? When that certainly happened. And what we find, I believe, when we start doing mindfulness practice is the degree to which many of us live relating to the objects of our experience, of our knowing. So it's very interesting, for example, to study your desires, which mindfulness students are supposed to do. You're supposed to become real experts of your nature of your desires. And often when people pay attention to the desires in kind of normal life, they're noticing what they want. Thank you. And so we get lost in the object of the desire. In mindfulness, what we train ourselves to do is to, in a sense, disconnect us from the object of desire without necessarily letting go of the desire, the desiring. So we let go of what we desire, but we don't let go of the desiring. And then you hang out in the feeling, in the body, in the mind, of desiring. And desiring feels maybe like a leaning forward, maybe like a tightening up, maybe like a, you know, all kinds of feelings that desire feels like. But that desiring doesn't have then an object anymore. You let go of the object. Or you're focusing primarily on the subjective experience of desiring. So the same thing with hate or anger towards something or somebody. Many of us get caught up in the object of the anger, the object of the aversion. It's possible to turn that attention around and look at what it feels like subjectively to be the person averting, the person hating. If we continue looking at the object of the hate, the object of the desire, then we're going to miss the very important element of the whole experience, which is a subjective experience that we're having. As long as we're looking at the object, the inner spiritual work that's possible in understanding how, what the seeds, what the roots, what the triggers are for our desire and our anger, won't be revealed. Spiritual work has a lot to do with going into oneself and finding the possibility of peace, of contentment, of love inside oneself. If you keep focusing on the objects of desire or aversion, that turning back to look for the source of transformation isn't happening. So there has to be some turning back into the subject, the subjective experience of what it's like. The subjective experience is a little bit tricky because many of us relate to ourselves as objects. So it becomes, I am the one, I am the one who feels desire. It's my desire. My desire is here, wherever we feel a desire. And I'm going to, fix that desire and make it into love. Or I'm going to, really kick that aversion out once and for all. I'm going to get in there and, or we judge it. We are judging the presence of our desire, which is a treat as an object. So we've turned away, perhaps, from the object of the desire, but then we've made the desiring the object of our judgments, our valuations, our criticism, our attempts to manipulate things and change. And that's just kind of doing the same thing again. So to turn into pure subject is simply to be there in the middle of the feeling tone, the felt sense of the experience, without imagining that you're separate from it, judging it. Just feeling it, being present for it. Now, if this is making sense to you, then the idea is to extend this idea one step, and the same, that's the way of making, of being, of experiencing the subjective sense of what's happening can be extended outwards to other people. Other people feel great happiness, they feel great suffering. And rather than focusing on that's their happiness, that's their suffering, we can just be present for the situation subjectively. What does it feel like subjectively to experience this? To be in the presence of somebody else's suffering, there's empathy. We'll feel compassion, we'll feel empathy, perhaps. We'll feel something. Otherwise we wouldn't know that they were suffering. We'll know something, otherwise we wouldn't know. So to experience that as subject, as if it's not happening outside of yourself. Now, some people will protest here and say, "What do you mean, pure subject? That sounds like very selfish. All about myself. Now I'm supposed to just pay attention to what it's like subjectively." Well, subjectively in English sometimes means through the filters of our bias. I think in Zen we're talking about is actually stepping out of our bias. As soon as there's bias, whenever there's bias, there's an object. But when we step out of objects and the objectifying world entirely, then the world itself becomes pure subject. And when the world becomes pure subject, it isn't anymore that you're here in a self-centered way, creating the notion I am. The notion, the idea, I am, doesn't arise in the felt sense of pure subject. So in Zen, they talk about the experience of big mind, where you feel everything is held and contained within the big mind of awareness. And perhaps a little sense of this is to, if you just kind of look around, get a sense of the room we're sitting in and all the people in the room. And then, in normal parlance, we say that we're sitting inside this room. But from a particular perspective, it's valid to say the room is inside of us. Because the whole experience of us being in, physically we're inside the room. I'm not going to argue that. But in the way that we experience this room and the people in the room, it's only happening at the place where there's contact with our senses. And that's not out there. That's with my eyes and my ears and my tactile sensations and all that. And so the whole world of you out there is being constructed and reconstructed within the field of my senses. So when I enter that field of subjective sensing, you're all inside of me. That makes sense? Does it sound like I'm crazy? So remember, I'm not denying ordinary ways of understanding what situations are like. We have to be able to hold two different perspectives. But there is a perspective that we often overlook, when we always try to do things kind of rationally or kind of normal, the treat things as from the laws of physical reality. So to experience things as pure subject, and the advantage of that for us is that I think it's much more realistic that way. But one of the advantages is that then the response to the suffering of the world doesn't come from you, doesn't come from the conceit of I am, doesn't come from the conceit that I'm the one who's feeling the world's suffering, I'm the one who has to be the world's savior, I'm the one who has to come up with an answer, I'm the one who doesn't have an answer of how to deal with this crisis. There isn't any notion of I in it. But that does not mean the person becomes passive. The seemingly miraculous thing about sitting in pure subject is that the pure subject is responsive to the world. It wants to respond. It wants to, it might not have always know the best solution to a problem, but its impulse is to respond in some way. Just like the impulse of a child, of a parent, when the child is cold in the middle of the night, is to pull the blanket over the child. That's not a lazy thing. It's not an energetic thing to do. It's just what's done. So the experience of big mind, of pure subject, arises when we're no longer taking things as objects, but rather reside in the experience itself of how it actually feels and felt, without constructing me and mine on top of it. And that's a responsive place to come from. And that's why the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion is depicted as someone who simply is, arranging the pillow more at night. It's as simple as that. So the ideal of compassion in Buddhism, in the Mahayana tradition, is expressed in the Bodhisattva vows. And the Bodhisattva vows seem impossible. They seem ludicrous to some people. They're the vows, beings are numberless. That means a lot. I vow to save them. Well, actually, in Chinese, they don't have the pronoun I, but in English, we do. We say that. So then we're already in trouble. But beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. And so this seems like it's huge. Why would anybody in their right mind commit themselves to saving all beings in the world? I don't think it's meant to be taken exactly literally in that kind of way, in the kind of rational mind that sees beings out there and I'm here, but rather taken from the stance of this pure subject, that when I encounter the world, the vow of the Bodhisattva is not to go out there and try to save the world, which is the usual popular idea of the Bodhisattva, the great saviors in Buddhism. The dedication of the Bodhisattva is to come back to this pure subject and respond from the world from there. Respond to the world from that. And in that way, the Bodhisattva's efforts, hopefully, are effortless. And they're not oppressed by the idea that they have to save all beings in the universe. They're going to come back to this pure subject and then respond to whatever is happening in front of them. And so the people who make the Bodhisattva vows are making that vow to live in the world, try to live the world in this mode of subjectivity that I'm trying to talk about today. It's said that the four Bodhisattva vows are a direct derivative of the Four Noble Truths. And I won't go into the correlation, how that works, but you maybe figure it out for yourself. But one of the things I'm fond about the Four Noble Truths is there's no pronouns in the way the Four Noble Truths are stated. It doesn't say, I suffer, the cause of my suffering is my desire. I will attain, the end of my suffering is my cessation. I'm going to follow the Eightfold Path. It doesn't say, you all out there suffer, and the cause of your suffering is your craving, and your suffering will end when your craving ceases. It simply, the Four Noble Truths are simply stated, suffering exists, there's a cause of suffering, and that cause is craving. There's a cessation of that suffering, and there's a path to follow to bring an end to suffering. And what I think is beautiful about that is that it doesn't, is that, I mean, the instructions in practice is then to pay attention to the First Noble Truth, to pay attention to suffering. But it doesn't say pay attention to it only inside of yourself. It doesn't pay attention to it only outside of yourself. It just simply says pay attention to it. And from a Zen point of view that I'm trying to convey today, it just, you simply are open to pay attention to suffering as it exists, as you encounter it. Equally, if it's inside of you or if it's outside of you. The subjective mind doesn't differentiate, doesn't select one over the other, but rather responds to what is actually the predominant situation. And the last thing I'll say, I think probably many of you are familiar with the Tibetan practice of Tonglen, which is a practice of imagining or breathing, as you're breathing, imagining, or maybe more than just imagining, breathing in the suffering of the world, and then breathing out happiness to the world. So this is a cycle. You breathe, you take on all the suffering of the world, and then you give the world all your happiness. Now, who in their right mind would do that? You know, it's give all your happiness away and take on all the burdens of the world. But it's a beautiful and very profound practice, because if you're willing to just take on all the suffering of the world, because the normal thing is we want to protect ourselves. You know, I'm not going to open to that, thank you. And we put up boundaries and barriers and self-protective mechanisms. But by doing this Tonglen practice, I believe how it works is that as you do it, you begin dissolving your self-protectiveness. You begin dissolving your fear that resists the suffering of the world. You dissolve the sense that I am over here experiencing that suffering. And as all those boundaries dissolve, it's just pure subject of suffering. Suffering comes. And happiness goes. And there's no inside and outside. There's no out there and in here. It's just this experience of pure subject. And then the experience of Tonglen, I hope, I haven't done it to this degree, but I hope then becomes that experience of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of great compassion, who arranges as her pillow in the middle of the night in order to save all beings. So I hope I was able to convey this evening maybe a different way of understanding compassion than how it's normally thought about. And so that when you think about responding to the world compassionately, it's not exhausting. It's not a thing that you have to do, even though you're the one who's doing it. That makes sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah, somewhat? So let's have... we have a few minutes. If there are questions or comments or rebuttals or reservations. Yes?
You said this is a Zen perspective or Zen practice. How does that differ from Vipassana? I mean, it sounded kind of the same. The difference.
I think the difference is, I believe that ultimately it comes to the same, but it depends a little bit on how you get there. So, in Vipassana, in the way it's generally taught, tends to focus very much, and especially intensive practice, on our own experience and what's going on inside of us. It tends to be that kind of subjective, kind of inside. In Zen practice, tends to focus a lot on the compassionate response to the world, being sensitive to the world around us. So it's like coming at it from two different angles. Another way of thinking of this is that in Zen practice, the instructions for Zazen for a beginner is basically just jump right into pure subject. We don't say that in Vipassana. In Vipassana we say, pay attention carefully to what's going on inside of you, what's going on. Pay careful attention. And as you pay careful attention, you'll begin understanding where the barriers and boundaries, where the tension is. And as the tension begins to dissolve, the Vipassana student will come into this feeling, I think, of somewhat like pure subject, very similar to what they talk about in Zen. So in Zen, you expect to kind of just jump right in. And in Vipassana, you're kind of told to kind of first put your toe in the water and, you know, get comfortable with that, and then put your foot in and get comfortable with that, and then put your whole leg in and get comfortable with that. And by the time you're all the way in, you know how to swim. Whereas a Zen person who jumps right in sometimes drowns. Something like that. Yes?
Book a lot today, so it reminded me of time and again there are acts of just almost ridiculous courage that occur from time to time.
Oh, yeah.
And then by ordinary people, and when they're interviewed, like jumping in front of a train to rescue a child, that sort of thing. And I was struck always when people said that they didn't think to do that, and when they saw that person, it almost felt like they were being pulled into the train. And another thing that struck me is often these acts are not only of foolish courage, but often have been remarkable in the physical feats that were accomplished. So, and I don't know how reliable the sources are, but this I've seen often, somebody be able to lift such as something that was just weighed tons and tons by this old 50-year-old guy, and he says, I don't know how I got this strength.
Yeah, there's amazing things that happen, and it seems that these things can happen without any self-conscious concern about me here and the person over there. It's just, you know, it's just the response happens. That's why it's in Mahayana Buddhism, sometimes, this is not responding directly, but in Mahayana Buddhism they talk a lot about emptiness, but emptiness is understood to contain compassion within it. Or to put it in Theravadan terms, we talk a lot about not self or selflessness. Selflessness or not self is not the absence. I shouldn't speak for Theravadan Buddhism. Let's say for the Mahayana, especially since I have this class where I just on Saturday, I told the whole class the day long on the topic of not self, and so I was about to put my foot in my mouth. And people who took the class know that. Never, but the problem with teaching too much, they
put our hands over our heads.
Yeah. People who took the class, don't listen to this.
It's a different day.
Yeah, different day. Anyway, I just leave it at that. Emptiness, the great Mahayana experience of emptiness, is not understood to be the total absence of something, because compassion is understood to be to reside in that emptiness. Yes.
Well, I think it's kind of a coincidence for me that you talk about compassion tonight, because some of you may know Nancy Emerald, whose son just died on the train tracks in Sunnyvale last week. She's an old friend of mine. I hadn't seen in a long time. Her only child died. And I went to the funeral, and she experienced a death that I had in my family a number of years ago. So going to the funeral, we were quite one when we encountered each other. And I haven't been able to call her back. Partly because of exactly what you're saying. It's as though I've gotten away from the oneness, you know, that I'm suffering to too. Or we're all, you know, the suffering isn't just her, and thinking there's something I need to do. So I kind of needed to talk about it tonight, say that that was going on, and almost made an announcement about it earlier, asking people to send prayers to medical fraternity. Wasn't sure how much of that was ego, and I got all mixed up about it.
Part of, I think being wise, relating wisely to a situation like this is not to set up the pure subject as the ideal to measure yourself against, but rather to see the ego or see this, the self-defensive stances or the self-protective stances, and see that as part, see that also as part of this, what's held in your subjective experience. Hold that also, and be able to be someone who is in conflict and intention. And if you accept that part of yourself, it might be easier. The whole situation is more realistic that way, rather than thinking, "Oh, I have to kind of push away that part of myself that, you know, is objectifying the situation," but rather trying to relax and say, "Okay, this is what's happening, and can I accept this now too? Can I have compassion for all for this now?" And because it sounds to me like self-compassion here is very much needed too,
mm-hmm.
Not just simply compassion for her, but also for you. Yes.
What can we do in practice to at least work toward this objectification of the subjectivity?
In Vipassana practice, there's a number of things I could say, but the basic principle that I feel it's very important for all of you to understand around Vipassana practice is Vipassana practice focuses less on attaining the ideal and more on paying attention to what blocks the ideal, what gets in the way. So if you feel like that you live in the world of objectification, where I'm here and the world's out there and I'm all concerned about myself, rather than just kind of pushing that aside and trying to kind of experience some kind of subjective state, in mindfulness we pay very careful attention to the I-making and my-making, how it works. How is it I protect myself? How is it I build myself up? How is it I'm self-concerned? How is it my defensiveness gets in the way? How is it that my ego gets in the way of pure compassion? And so we, by paying attention to what's actually going on, rather than what we want to go on, then we can kind of resolve and dissolve it and work with it. And then with time, it dissolves and then the natural compassion will be there. So that makes sense? Last one, then we'll...
I always like the phrase of to care and not to care.
Yes.
It's such a good balance.
So she said she likes the phrase from T.S. Eliot's poem, The Four Quartets, where he the expression, to care and not to care. So remember that we have to hold both. We have to hold two different perspectives here. And if you only had now thought, I'm supposed to go off into pure subject, then you become a little bit of a dangerous person, because then you forget that there is really objects and people, and you have to be able to somehow negotiate both. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me of everything, and between the two, my life has to flow. And hopefully, your mindfulness practice will help you to be flexible, so you can flow freely back and forth as needed. So thank you very much for listening.